June the 18th, 1972. The Washington Post didn't usually put local break-ins on its front page, but this one, at the Watergate apartment complex on the Potomac River, was not run-of-the-mill.
Five men, one of whom said he is a former employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, were arrested at 2:30 a.m. yesterday in what authorities described as an elaborate plot to bug the offices of the Democratic National Committee here.
The Post quickly linked the burglars and the large sums of money sloshing through their bank accounts to the Committee to Re-elect the President, unpopularly known as CREEP. But the White House insisted that the attempted bugging of the Democrats' HQ was the work of a few out-of-control political mavericks. At a press conference, President Richard Nixon stated that after a thorough internal investigation,
I can say categorically that, no one in the White House staff, no one in this administration, presently employed, was involved in this very bizarre incident. What really hurts in matters of this sort is not the fact that they occur, because overzealous people in campaigns do things that are wrong. What really hurts is if you try to cover it up.
Wise words. If only Nixon had heeded them. It wasn't the Watergate burglary that brought him down, but the attempt to cover it up. Yet the cover-up, like the burglary, was symptomatic of the climate of ruthless, paranoid law-breaking that characterized the Nixon presidency. Almost certainly Nixon didn't know about Watergate in advance, but he had fostered the climate that encouraged such actions. His siege mentality assumed that they were all out to get him, the Democrats, the press, the liberal establishment. As he said to Henry Kissinger and other aides early in his presidency,
one day we will get him. We'll get him on the ground where we want him. We'll stick our heels in, step on him hard and twist, right? Yeah, Henry knows what I mean. You get him on the floor and you step on him, crush them, show them no mercy.
So Nixon sanctioned break-ins and illegal wiretaps of opponents. Furious about the constant exposures of government policy, particularly on Vietnam, he also created a White House operation to plug the leaks, known as the Plumbers. And he was right at the center of the cover-up that followed the arrests at Watergate. Less than a week later, on June the 23rd, he told aides to warn the FBI,
don't go any further into this case. Period.
He used the pretext that the case involved national security. Nixon was secretly recording his conversations, for the record and for his memoirs. But this tape proved the smoking gun that would later seal his fate. The cover-up, organized by White House counsel John Dean, kept the lid on the case until after the November election. But in the new year of 1973, that lid was blown right off. There were two detonators. The first was that Nixon's landslide re-election victory had not been matched on Capitol Hill. The Democrats still controlled both houses of Congress, and they appointed a special committee to inquire into Watergate. The other detonator of publicity was that the Watergate burglars and their immediate bosses were prosecuted. The trial ran from January to March 1973, causing acute embarrassment for the White House. And at the end, faced with years as jailbirds, the ringleaders were ready to sing unless given big bucks in hush money. On March the 21st, Dean discussed the mess with Nixon.
There's no doubt about the seriousness of the problem we've got. We have a cancer.
We have a cancer within close to the presidency that's growing. It's growing daily. Because, one, we're being blackmailed, and two, people are going to start perjuring themselves.
Nixon's main concern was to keep the burglars quiet.
How much money do you need?
I would say these people are going to cost $1 million over the next 2 years.
Oh, we could get that. You could get $1 million. And you could get it in cash. I know where it could be gotten.
But the cancer kept spreading. luridly exposed by the X-ray eyes of the American media, led by the Washington Post. Hoping to save himself, Nixon accepted the resignation of his closest aides, Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, both of whom had been involved in the cover-up. The pressure was now getting to him. His hands shook, his breath often smelt of liquor. He told Haldeman in despair,
"Well, you know, Bob, there's something I've never told anybody before, not even you. Every night since I've been president, every single night before I've gone to bed, I've knelt down on my knees beside my bed and prayed to God for guidance and help in this job. Well, last night, before I went to bed, I knelt down, and this time I prayed that I wouldn't wake up in the morning. I just couldn't face going on."
Nixon was prone to self-pity, and he loved melodrama. But even so, this probably came from the heart. The most powerful man in the world, custodian of the nuclear codes that could exterminate millions, he could not stop the wheels of justice and democracy from gradually grinding him into political dust. A fighter all his life, he waged a dogged rearguard action on two fronts. Against the Senate Watergate Committee, now in full cry with televised hearings, and against the independent special prosecutor, whom he'd been forced to concede because the Justice Department was implicated in the cover-up. Ironically, though, it was Nixon who sealed his own fate. In mid-July, an aide admitted to the Watergate Committee that the president had been taping his own conversations. All through the summer of 1973, Nixon resisted the attempts of the Senate committee and the special prosecutor to subpoena the tapes. Watergate was now consuming much of his time and energy. It also sapped his political credibility. Harried in one televised press conference by a battery of questions about the tapes, the cover-up, and even his personal finances, he exclaimed,
"I want to say this to the television audience. I've made my mistakes, but in all of my years of public life, I have never profited from public service. I've earned every cent. And in all of my years of public life, I have never obstructed justice. People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook."
If a president needs to say that to the American people, he's as good as finished. In a war of attrition over the winter, Nixon was forced to release some of the tapes and further transcripts. Laboriously, staff of the House Judiciary Committee prepared the case for impeachment. One of them was a young Yale Law School graduate named Hillary Rodham. As she recalled later, these were the days before personal computers, so they used index cards to record all the facts.
"We typed one fact per card, the date of a memo, the topic of a meeting, and cross-referenced it with other facts. Then we looked for patterns. By the end of the inquiry, we had compiled more than 500,000 index cards."
Impeachment, the constitutional provision for trying a president for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, had been used only once before, unsuccessfully, against President Andrew Johnson in 1868. But at the end of July 1974, the House Judiciary Committee approved the Articles of Impeachment, and the Supreme Court rejected the president's final effort to withhold key tapes, including the so-called smoking gun transcript, when he tried to stop the FBI investigation into Watergate. This was the end, and the president resigned on August the 9th. In a tearful, rambling farewell, he told White House staff,
"Always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself."
If Nixon had followed his own precepts, he might have avoided self-destruction. Most of the world watched in bemusement as the Watergate drama unfolded. It seemed incredible that the globe's most powerful leader could be toppled by what seemed like a minor burglary. Certainly it made no sense in Beijing or Moscow, where far graver breaches of civil liberty were routine, there was virtually no legal accountability, and any political opposition was inconceivable. Mao Zedong blamed it all on what he called too much freedom of expression. In fact, Watergate was symptomatic of the back-channel, backstabbing methods by which the Nixon presidency operated. They lay behind its foreign policy triumphs as much as its domestic scandals. The standard defense of Nixon is that bypassing Congress, bureaucracy, and the media was necessary for diplomatic success, because the US political system, in which power is packaged out, deliberately frustrates vigorous executive leadership. As Kissinger put it,
"His administrative approach was weird and its human cost unattractive. Yet history must also record the fundamental fact that major successes were achieved that had proved unattainable by conventional procedures."
There is some truth in this claim. These methods got him summits in Beijing and Moscow. But one could equally say that, through their secrecy and deception, Nixon and Kissinger failed to establish a strong domestic consensus behind their foreign policies. This, in turn, undermined their achievements. Historian Arthur Schlesinger saw Vietnam and Watergate in a longer perspective, as the culmination of what he called an imperial presidency that had been growing throughout the Cold War. According to Schlesinger,
"The imperial presidency was essentially the creation of foreign policy. It was a combination of doctrines and emotions, a belief in permanent and universal crisis, fear of communism, faith in the duty and the right of the United States to intervene swiftly in every part of the world. This had brought about the unprecedented centralization of decisions over war and peace in the presidency. And as it overwhelmed the traditional separation of powers in foreign affairs, it began to aspire toward an equivalent centralization of power in the domestic polity."
At a press conference late in his presidency, Nixon was reminded by a journalist of a story about Benjamin Franklin back in 1787.
"When leaving the Constitutional Convention, he was asked, 'What have you given us, sir, a monarchy or a republic?' Franklin answered, 'A republic, sir, if you can keep it.' Mr. President, in the prevailing pessimism of the lingering matter we call Watergate, can we keep that republic, sir, and how?"
"Well, I would certainly not be standing here answering these questions unless I had a firm belief that we could keep the republic, that we must keep it, not only for ourselves, but for the whole world."
Coming from Richard Nixon, those words sounded hollow. But in the end, America's Republican democracy, however clumsy, volatile, and partisan, had brought down the imperial president.